You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson on June 10th, 2020, very early in the morning. I want to extend thanks for my friends who have donated to me for various research expenses and to function. It means a lot to me. And as always, I welcome and actually need them, especially in the summer. And it's difficult to keep a pleasant outlook, an optimistic outlook, whether it be, you know, emotional or financial or anything else today. I'm not going to say much about the racial situation because it's not really interesting. We have all predicted this decades ago. There is not a shred of any of this that hasn't been predicted, that we don't know exactly how it works and how it functions and where it comes from, who's doing it and why. I predicted this a few months ago. Otherwise, it really isn't, you know, this is just one of many, although this case is far worse because of the, because the lockdown and the constant regime backing, to the point where every major corporate entity has backed the violence. And I've said this, this is what corporate America is. So the battle lines are drawn. Understand that corporate capital is extremely liberal and as anti-white as any other entity that's out there. I've been saying this for decades. And those who support the rioters aren't just enemies of our people. They're our personal enemies because they state they want to do us harm. And that's where we are right now. More interesting than that, though, I want to talk about another revolution. A revolution I've spoken about at length. I believe the very second show I did at Voice of Reason was on Peter the Great's revolution in Russia. Now, in particular, I want to talk about an institution that doesn't get any real in-depth discussion, but it's the institution that showcased Peter's consecration to the god Dionysius. This is not a flippant matter. This is a very serious pagan connection with the cult of Bacchus or Dionysius that he instituted in Petersburg. He was, at the very least you could call him, Peter was a libertine pagan. The point of his reign was to force the modern world on an unwilling population. His hatred for old Russia knew no bound. He would do anything to destroy the traditions of the nations that he ruled. As I've said many times before, you know, the Orthodox are so clueless about things. You know, the entire Russian Synod was purged and replaced. There wasn't a shred of canonical order to any of it. I don't hear any of these lengthy canonical debates about succession and everything else like you hear, you know, in the 20th century. There wasn't a shred of legality or regularity here. And when he purged the Sobor, he brought in Feofan Prokopovich, who I've dealt with at some length in many places. He was a Uniate, Orthodox. Uniate Orthodox went back and forth depending on where he was. He was, I guess, the best you could say about him is that he was really a Protestant. The worst was that he was a materialist, and his he certainly was a follower of Thomas Hobbes. If he was a full follower of Thomas Hobbes, then he would be a materialist. The church carried on only through the old believers and other dissenters worldwide, and you had a mass exodus of monastics, and they founded skeets like Manyava in the Austrian Empire. The institution I'm talking about was called by Peter the all-joking, most drunken, and madcap sobor. It's a that's my translation of it. There's a lot of very odd translations floating around out there. But, you know, the mad cop, the wild, or even insane, there really is no other way to describe it. It's meant to be a council of his new church, which was dedicated to the god Dionysius and based almost entirely on alcohol abuse. And this was a semi-official organ. It was created in the early 1690s. And it became very significant. What I want to do is talk about the inner workings of this synod, the extent that the surviving records permit. You don't really see this in academia. It is sometimes it's dismissed as an eccentricity. Sometimes it's a kind of like a peasant carnival or something like that. But this synod was connected to Peter's religious policy and the phenomenon of enlightened absolutism. That's a concept that graduate students usually use to comprehend something very, very complex. But these people, it would be Frederick the Great or Catherine or Peter, it's about shifting the foundation of the state's power. Modernism, liberalism, liberal democracy, all of this has to be forced on a population at the barrel of gun. So-called free market, all this stuff has to be forced. And this is the point of the so-called enlightened absolutists. It's the full admission of the concept that the modern world needed an extremely strong centralized state to smash older institutions so the new oligarchy can take its place. But Frederick the Great gave the institution its name, the absolutist idea, and the court hack Voltaire lived at his palace. Voltaire believed, of course, that violence is absolutely necessary to lead a population to accept secularism. The whole point was to use the state to enforce his ideology on the ruins to build what he calls enlightenment. The so-called social contract, which I've dealt with many other places, it's one of the sillier ideas in political theory. Which, of course, is also based on the idea of progress. So it implies that the ruling class knew human nature, knew the direction of history, and somehow was given this mystic permission to rule by making some claim, some completely speculative claim about a contract during the time of the state of nature. I can't get into it because it really is stupid. But prior to the modern era, all states were small. No bureaucracies existed, no police or prisons existed anywhere. These are creations of the modern world, and Russia's creation of Peter. I don't know if you guys have ever seen these, the documentaries on YouTube about medieval torture devices. I've seen a few of these. I've left some enlightening responses in the comments. You go through these, it's kind of an interesting subgenre, and most of them never existed. Most of them are mythical. Most of them couldn't possibly work. And those that are real are purely modern. Middle Ages is something that moderns like to use. It's like a sore system. They could throw whatever that they don't need anymore, what they don't like, down into it. And they claim Middle Ages, and that's what it was. And it doesn't matter when the years are. We don't understand something in history, they claim it as medieval. Now, it's an error that, you know, these systems want to abolish the various forms of serfdom, guild labor, noble privilege, all this kind of thing. But given the definition of progress that they held, it's a circle. It's all based on force. Today's Voltaire in university says a liberty was being introduced by some mysterious force, but It's simply a matter of clearing the field for different elites. The new oligarchy that came in on the backs of the destroyed old one was far more rapacious. Now, this is connected with the drunken sober, which I call it for short. Peter was going to force through incredible acts of violence. None of the enlightened absolutists in this early modern period could ever be as violent as Peter. The difference between Peter and Lenin was that Lenin had the modern world. He had modern technology and the industrial development of the Tsarist era to work with. Peter did not. The drunken sobor, the drunken synod, was one of these, it's a form of parody and mockery that was used to destroy traditional institutions in the city. It was a public phenomenon. It was designed to mock Russia and the church and to destroy the faith in the crown that Peter wore. The memoirs of contemporaries leave no doubt that the purpose of this synod was to shock Russians to a state of confusion. The point was to parody and mock the rites of the church. It was a revolutionary act. When Peter married a drunken woman, called her Catherine the First, that was his earlier version of the Jacobin prostitute Momero, placed on the throne of the murder Archbishop of Paris. She was worshipped as a goddess of reason. This is the exact same phenomenon two generations earlier. Now, the head of this drunken synod was the so-called Prince Pope. Peter was in the background. He called himself Protodeacon Peter Mikhailov, which is odd that he was, called himself just a protodeacon, staying in the background, suggesting that he's a pawn of some other more powerful force. The first prince pope, the prince ruler, was courtier prince, Fyodor Romanovsky, who became head of Peter's secret police. Peter called him king and blessed royal majesty, then called himself the serf and the least slave of the prince. Peter appointed the first prince pope, and he had these clownish patriarchs elected by the whole Sobor. The first prince pope, his name was the Patriarch of Moscow, Kokluski and all Yaluza, was Matvey Naryshkin, his cousin. And then it was soon replaced by Nikita Zhotov, who was his teacher at one point. Zhotov dies, and the so-called papal throne in 1717 was taken by Peter Paterlin. And his title was the most majestic and most intoxicated metropolitan of St. Petersburg, Izora, Kronstadt, and in Germanland, for 11 years. And then it went to Zhotov's widow, who was forcibly married to Peter in 1721. In the preserved letters that exist of this institution, there's a jargon, there's a coded way of speaking. Drunkenness was called Avashka Kimonitsky, or just Avashka. Debauchery was called Gremka. The coded language was everywhere. But what this so-called madcap or drunken sobor did was, it's something of immense interest. It contained all of Peter's elites, Franz Lefort, Patrick Gordon, Alexander Menshikov, Boris Golitsyn, all of whom were essential for Peter's revolution. There were a few female members, of course he had to, and it's no coincidence that Peter also abolished the segregation of women as social function. He wasn't motivated by any kind of feminism, but motivated by the same impulse that all men who pretend to be feminists have. So he even had a princess abbess, Daria Zemskaya and Anastasia Golitsyna. These are the wives of the servants of Dionysius. The Sobor, this is a public institution. They had an entire staff of professional comedians. The Russian says stutterers, comedians, and screamers, whatever those are. Singers, musicians, jesters, fools, and men depicting Dionysius were part of these rituals. They had public processions through the streets, and one of them wound up at Zhotov's house. And the order of everything was laid out in great detail, and Peter wrote all of this. The spring singers, whatever that is, brothers, deacons, priests, noble monks, archimandrites, suffragan bishops, and the household of the prince pope, all drunkenly mocked as if it were a typical Orthodox procession. Zhotov's servants were the monks of the great monastery. and they all carried pictures of Dionysius, and they'd have acolytes behind them carrying big buckets of vodka, and one after another, the archpriest. Even today, these offices defy full definition, but all of the elite of Petersburg was present here. This was an actual institution where Peter dedicated himself to Dionysius and alcohol abuse, with every major elite family in Petersburg had to take part. So they reached Zoltov's home, and this has all been planned in advance. They dispersed into three separate rooms called conclaves. In one room, the bishop sat down, so-called bishop sat down. Another, the full-fledged members of the synod, and the third was the house of the prince pope. And all these rooms were prepared for a ritual. The prince escorted the bishops, so to speak, to the room allotted for them, and bowing to them, he spoke to them about the nomination of three candidates from among them for the position of representative of Dionysius. So the vicar of Dionysius, so to speak. Someone locked the door, left, and then they drank for the rest of the night. The records that Peter wrote, the invocations, these people were to diligently search for the truth and guilt while praying to Father Dionysius, who was most like himself, who would be his vicar. They would vote using balls that were actually taken from the scrotum of various male animals. They called themselves architects at this point, managed to identify the most worthy, the person closest to the pagan god, but the criteria unfortunately hasn't been preserved. But Turlin by this point had the title of Archbishop of Petersburg in the diocese of drunkards, gluttons, and fools. So Peter even created, an bureaucracy. He added cardinals, like this is Rome. Every year, Peter improved the charter, inventing and supplementing statutes and regulations with his own hand. He worked on these rituals right up to the Battle of Poltava. This was essential to him somehow. But this was the elite, and therefore these were dissolute, oligarchic drinking companions. To a great extent, this was to show his control over the elite. My contempt for Peter the Great isn't based on nothing. So the most bizarre things that Peter would do with this drunken synod, this existed for 30 years. Peter liked to force people to marry each other. Zoltov, who at this point in time was 84 years old, not his teacher Zoltov, another one who was in the army, and his son had begged Peter to rid his father of this shame. The bride was Anna Peshkova, from an elite family, about 60 years old. And Peter planned these huge, grandiose, very bizarre wedding preparations. Remember, this is as the Northern War is raging at this time. But this is his priority. All court ranks and ladies were sent in order to prepare and participate in the upcoming celebration. Count Golovkin, the chancellor, was given a detailed description of the chosen costumes. These costumes were under personal inspection of Peter twice, December 12, 1714, and January 15th of the following year. This is a big deal for him. These are full-scale rituals that he publicly put together and wrote the invocations for in Petersburg. He personally wrote all the instructions and orders relating to the ceremonial on the day of this bizarre wedding. Cannon from the Peter and Paul fortress would go off, and all the men and women would take part in the masquerade. They'd go from house to house. And the procession would begin. They start from the Imperial Palace and crossing the ice across the Neva, went to the other side of the Church of Peter and Paul. And there, somehow, a 90-year-old priest from Moscow was waiting for the bride and groom. No one's entirely sure what this poor priest was told. Robozanovsky, of course, the head of the police, opened it up, and he was dressed as a faux prince. Peter the Great called himself David, very much like Cromwell. He had even had a lyre in his hand, and it was covered in bearskin, which, by the way, follows the ritual of the Dionysian cult that the myth was retold by Livy. He rode in a sleigh pulled by four bears, and a fifth was trained to stand instead of a footman. These animals were whipped the entire time. They would roar in pain. Then in these very high sleighs behind him were these so-called newlyweds. There'd be Cupid figures everywhere, a deer decorated with huge horns, and the coachman was a goat trained to stand. This is where his money was. This is public money went to this. He did it again in 1720. He married Petrulin to the widow of Zoltov. He reveled in these bizarre fake marriages. He built a pyramid in Petersburg right in front of the Senate, and he put a bed in the middle of it. And he bore holes in the walls of this pyramid, and the crowds of the city could go and look and see what's going on the inside. These rituals, you know, we don't have detailed descriptions of every single thing that happened. But you had ambassadors, you had public elites who wrote about this later. There's a ceremony where everyone except Peter would come to Petrulin, who was a patriarch, and he had overthrown the patriarchate, and this is what he put in his place. You go up to Petrulin, you kiss his right hand, and he held the great eagle. The great eagle was a giant bucket of vodka with the coat of arms on it. He kissed him on the bosom, whatever that means, and drank from this giant vat. And he did it in allegiance to Dionysius. Then it ended with Petrulin, the prince pope, being lowered naked into a giant vat of both beer and wine mixed together. So there, Peter Petrulin, very contented with his life, sailed on this bucket. It was huge, almost a swimming pool. And everyone with him floating in it drank from the same vat. There's one contemporary who wrote this January 10th, 1718. When everyone gathered in the Prince Pope's house, then priests and other worthies sat down in their places. The messenger of the cardinal, the protodeacon, from a secluded throne, sent from the newly elected to the whole sobor, led him respectfully into the collected group. They carried two flasks before him, filled with very strong wine, one sweetened, the other not, and two dishes, one with cucumber, the other with cabbage. They put this before the monarch on a carpet. The archpriest on a high throne sat by degree in the right and left sides. Then the newly elected bowed to the Caesar's majesty, and priests prepared the gifts one by one to him, giving a brief compliment about his delivery. And the provider would ask him, "What do you ask from our moderation?" Then he would answer, "Even to be an extreme priest and the first son of our father Bacchus." And the provider then would respond, "May Bacchus' drunkenness be with you." Now, there, of course, this is a serious matter here. This is the cult that Peter had created for the elite in St. Petersburg. And this is very Masonic, the questioning back and forth. One question that's been preserved was given to important participants. You would say, "How do you keep the law of Bacchus? And do you have any suspicions about it?" Now, some of the replies are, let's just say, untranslatable, but it ends with the invocation to our father Bacchus. And then, of course, one of the doxologies, "Bacchus' drunkenness will be with you always, all the days of your life." And then you would kneel and you would stick your head in a giant vat of vodka. And the priest then would sing hymns to Dionysius, hymns authored by Peter himself. He even designed vestments. And they were meant to parody the clerical vestments. So instead of the panagia, the icon of Mary around his neck, they wore a flask. And then they had the Prince Pope had a mitre, and Bacchus, of course, was depicted on it. You have enough correspondence and private documents that lay all this out. So when someone was anointed and brought into this synod, you would take the elect and you would anoint him with vodka on his head and around his eyes in the image of a circle. And the invocation was, "Let your mind spin and may such circles of different kinds appear before you all the days of your life." Another one is, "Let your hand tremble all the days of your life." The final prayer was of the man would deliver from Christianity, in essence. Again, these are all authored by Peter. Then the archpriests laid their hands on all the newcomers and those elected to this, position of who's like Bacchus, whatever the heck that is. And here is the speech. This is what they would say. "I ordain this old drunk in the name of all drunkards, in the name of all the vials, all the grains, the name of all the fools, the jesters, the name of all the crazy people, the name of all the revelers, in the name of all vodka, of all wine, of all beer, the name of all honey, the name of all karazin, the name of all kvas, the name of all booze, all the barrels, all the buckets, all the mugs, in the name of all the glasses, all the cards, in the name of all the bones or dice, in the name of all tobacco, in the name of all taverns, as it is in the home of our Holy Father Bacchus. Amen. Peter wrote all of these himself. And then, with the newly elected, they put a cap on his head and they would yell Axios, which of course is a way to mock the Orthodox rite. The newly consecrated was sitting on his throne, and he'd take something from the Great Eagle, and he'd serve it to everybody. This is a extremely bizarre concept. And not a whole lot of people have tried to figure out what in the heck Peter is getting at here. Clearly, it's an anti-Christian cult. It comprises the high elite of Petersburg. It's revolutionary. It's extremely libertine. It's very ideological. The coup d'etat, the so-called mockery of the Franciscan monks, which the coup d'etat was their nickname, the knots on their belt. And Father Callot was a Frenchman who lived in Moscow, and they used him for their costumes. But the coup d'etat was also a pre-revolutionary group of Jacobins in France, later on dedicated to the overthrow of the crown. They were called the Society of Friends of the Rights of Man and Citizen. Now, this is before the group was formally founded, but these cultists were clearly early manifestation of it, because even the French envoy knew exactly what was going on here, and he protested. For some reason, Peter was dressed as a Dutch sailor, and he often would lead these processions personally. It's hard to figure out who goes where, what people are being ordained to. It really doesn't matter. By the time this actually would occur, everyone was so wasted, people couldn't figure it out or didn't remember. But that's not enough here. These crazy processions, they'd be cursing and swearing and they'd be wasted. This is the elite of the society. In old Russia, during Palm Sunday, there'd be the procession where the monarch would lead a horse with the patriarch sitting on it, showing that the state is subordinate to God, the church, and the canons. Well, Peter banned that rite in town, and he mocked it with his own version of it. Karakhan provides this particular version. After dinner on Palm Sunday, they would begin the procession. The Prince Pope would be there, the Patrick of the Comic with a new one. They'd be on a camel, and they'd go to the embankment of the Frazowski cellar, and they would drink there. Now, Berkholz is another variation of this. They would start off with a donkey, taking him on a donkey rather than what they used to do. And the most drunken sinner would then travel around the city on donkeys, oxen, and sleigh. They pulled by pigs, bears, and goats. And they go from home to aristocrat. And they would force each one to feed the guests and provide alcohol at great expense. Now, this isn't unknown. This is a way of keeping the elite on a tight leash. It's like the white elephant gift in Thai royalty. The emperor would give you this a beautiful, very rare white elephant, and it was a great honor to have it, except that it was an elephant, and it was extremely expensive to maintain. But what are you going to do? You can't kill it. You can't give it away. The emperor gave it to you. So you get ruined, or you have to go into debt. At the very least, you can't be very powerful having to take care of this thing. It was a way to keep the elites on a tight leash. And the synod would do this even on other holy days, not just Palm Sunday. The palace, the Laforto Palace, and was consecrated in honor of Dionysius, January 21st, 1699. It was a parody of the genuine consecration. It was named for Franz Lefort, which we mentioned already. So instead of sprinkling the building with holy water, participants would carry bowls of wine, honey, beer, and vodka, and they'd smoke the room with tobacco rather than incense. Instead of a cross, the Prince Pope had two cross smoking pipes. Tobacco smoke was condemned by the church and had no basis in Russian life. Neither did vodka, for that matter. These were revolutionary. Vodka was not the Russian drink prior to Peter. There was no smoking. Tobacco was not a thing in Russia. Neither was vodka. That itself was a revolutionary import. Now, that's just a smattering of this pagan insanity that Peter had enforced and imposed on everybody. You hear Anglo-American historians claim that the old believers thought that Peter was Antichrist because they're just too ignorant to understand what he was doing. No, these are the real reasons. This is all done in public. The whole point was to mock the church. This was a Jacobin revolution with a false monarch on the throne. In Russia, there was no way of overthrowing the crown. But you could put someone on it that was on your side. That's exactly what they did. Now, Dionysius, the same person as Bacchus in the Roman version. Dionysius was always, in the early myths, was depicted as a foreigner. So Peter brought foreigners in to rule Russia with him. He himself may have been a foreigner. I'm not so certain that the man who came back from the Grand Embassy was actually Peter. There's a drama and theater associated with the Dionysian cult. Therefore, this is all very much on public display. One of the titles Dionysius had was a Lichnitz, which is someone who uses a winnowing fan. So he could separate the wheat from the chaff. In other words, this is a way that Peter could discover who was with him and who wasn't. When you get wasted, you say things. And you do things that could be used against you later on. But the Bacchic mysteries are very serious. They're about revolutionary transition, not just in political life, but personal life too. Of course, like all of this stuff, it was for, especially for men and male sexuality. But Peter then helped create a way to ritualize women's sexuality too. Their new status was, of course, sexual objects for men. That's called liberation. He was bringing revolution to Russia using sexuality. It's often symbolized normally by invoking gods who rule over death and transformation, like Hades and Persephone. Also even a Dionysius' mother, Semele, who is also the goddess of initiation. Religion also would include in the sacrifices of goats and bulls, and they would wear masks. And you see this in Peter's display too. These animals would be abused and killed. The significance of the masks and to worship Dionysius is to ensure your anonymous status, a facade. Nothing is what it seems. It's symbolic manipulation. You hear the goat showing up in these rituals of Peter all throughout Petersburg all the time. The goat is a symbol of unrestrained sexuality. It was this in ancient Egypt, Rome. Even St. Isidore of Seville mentions it. He's associated with both Bacchus and Venus. But in both Eastern and Western churches, the male goat was a symbol of a man enslaved by vice. This is why the scapegoat in the Old Testament existed. There were sacrifices in the Old Testament. The scapegoat was, of course, just left to run out the gate. And this is where the silly associated with the devil having horns comes from, the goat connection. And you also see the bear. Bears are all over the place in these processions. They're trained to stand. They pull slaves, all this kind of thing. Now, it is a primary Russian symbol, but Peter wasn't thinking in these terms. In alchemy, the bear is the negrito of prime matter. This is the decomposition, the so-called blackness, the arcane sciences, to decompose all things into one mass, one uniform mass. The destruction of the old for the sake of building the new. This is prime matter in Aristotle, or matter without qualities, which is an inconceivable state, but one necessary in theory, if in fact form is now separated from matter. See, alchemy claims that all objects are identical, at least in their ingredients. Therefore, there's a prime matter. There's one thing out of which everything is created. Because everything that can be created, you can create anything if you know what the ritual to get to prime matter is. Everything has that as its foundation. Therefore, it can become anything. It also psychologically refers to the state of nature. The pure, undifferentiated state of the instincts and drives, passions as such. Not in any particular society. It's a very dangerous psychological situation leading to cruelty, normally. It's partially found in the unconscious. Even Livy talks about the Roman veneration, the Bacchic cult in Rome, which was also a revolutionary movement. Initially, it was a female thing, and men dressed like women. Three times a year, they would do their thing, whatever the heck that was. But usually, it was a drunken, and there were completely uninhibited orgies for all ages and social classes. It became almost a weekly thing. These people were, you know, as profanity, contempt for Roman law. They declared war on family and morality. They became a secretive cult, and they became a revolutionary movement. Eventually, it was suppressed by the state. About 7,000 were arrested. The senatorial edict, the Senatus Consultum de Bacchanalibus, was distributed throughout Rome. It banned this cult. So now, this is a pagan group so pagan that pagan Rome bans them. This was extremely dangerous. Now, the connection clearly with Peter is clear. Dressing up people in bearskins, like the initial myth, which I'm assuming all you guys know, the myth of Bacchus. The establishment of the old drunken sobor was an important part of the Petrine Revolution. It's taking the culture of the elite away from the church. Most of the time, of course, you know, it was this drunken gluttony. But it also became a mechanism for the selection and brainwashing of trusted advisors. They'd be tested for obedience when they were wasted. Peter somehow never got drunk. He was so big and quite possibly possessed, so he was always relatively sober. And alcohol was also used almost as a quicksilver in alchemical terms to break down class barriers. You get wasted to a certain point, it doesn't matter where you're from. Alcohol knows distinction in rank. Because he could do this, Peter can make this happen, and no one can stop him, he was greater than the church. The church was dethroned as a central element of the court, to say the least. Now, I've come across this in six documents, from the earliest from the 1690s, the latest from the 1720s. I have my bibliography where I've translated some of these, and it's very difficult to translate it because I don't know what's literal and what's not. Some of this stuff is just crazy. It's like the Pizzagate stuff, just in Russian. But even in Christmas time, they'd go from house to house, and all these mocking, you know, pornographic songs they would sing like carolers. And they go to, the host would have to feed them. This is a large group of people. Nobles were even insulted, sometimes even beaten up. The point, of course, was to blaspheme. This has nothing to do with carnival. This is not the issue. These were rituals written by Peter, dedicated to the god Dionysus. The Hellfire Clubs in the 18th century in the West were also dedicated to Dionysus. The Masonic veneration of the Dionysian is well known. People like Mackey and Pike say that the it's a revolutionary idea, returning man to his natural state. Intoxication, nakedness, the total lack of inhibition was like man before society. Of course, it's ridiculous and self-serving, but this is a ritualization of revolution. You know, this is a seasonal death, rebirth kind of theme. They even invoked spirit possession, the point being to liberate from society's rules and constraints or Christianity's rules and constraints. It celebrated that which was outside of society. It was a primordial celebration. Just, you know, make sure your wife doesn't go there. You would create a herd in these almost ecstatic, alcohol-fueled and drug-fueled, bizarre, you know, dances and everything else. This activity is like, it's just invigorating, cathartic, liberating, transformative. It was what revolution means today. Now, the Greek Dionysian rites were generally associated with females. But you see in the list of the few lists that survive, there's male names in it. It's overwhelming to see, you know, just how dedicated Peter was to this. And the invocations, of the ancient rituals to Dionysius are very similar to what Peter did. Here, the only invocation of Dionysius that survives from the Greek era says, I call upon loud roaring and reveling Dionysius, primeval, double natured, thrice born, Bacchic lord, wild, ineffable, secretive, two horned and two shaped, ivy covered bull face, warlike, howling, pure, you take raw flesh, you have feasts wrapped in foliage, decked with grape clusters. Immortal god sired by Zeus, when he made it with Persephone, an unspeakable union, hearken to my voice, O blessed one, with your fair girded nymphs, breathe on me in a spirit of perfect agape. You see, with these kind of things, it's the concept of revolution as a lack of constraint. It was ideologized. You have, whether it be French Revolution, black riots in America, the October Revolution, and everything in between, Dionysian symbols are everywhere, even if they don't even realize it. Nietzsche's Birth of Tragedy, which I can't spend much time on, is dedicated to the idea that the tragic, as a literary device, uses Dionysian elements to, again, reach this primordial unity, the underlying essence of all things, or substratum of all things, reviving our Dionysian nature, as he would say. He later claimed this was his youthful writing, but he claimed that the Greek spectators, the ritual drama we call tragedy, looking into the abyss of humans, pure human suffering, and not flinching, then would knowingly accept the meaning of their own life. The Apollinarian and Dionysian distinction was that life was struggle between these two elements, the formed and the unformed. And neither one really could win over the other. He said that the tragedy of ancient Greece was the highest form of art due to its mixture of these two elements. The unity of a life before words, before concepts, pure uniformity, but very primitive. On the other, of course, the ordered world of Apollo. He even says that the concept of tragedy comes from the word goat men. Tragoidea, or tragos, meaning goat. I don't know how true that is, but that was Nietzsche's claim, that this has to do, the tragedy itself comes from the goat man. But this is not idle theorizing. This was a decisive element in Peter's policy. He switched the foundation of his rule from the natural law idea and the Old Testament idea to the idea of Thomas Hobbes. The Orthodox Church was the one thing that stood in the way. In the Dionysian world, Nietzschean or otherwise, the passions rule, but not as such. They rule what all passions have in common, which Nietzsche will eventually say the will to power. They all have that one thing. Harmony can be found only in chaos, because there's no concept. Without concepts, there's no boundaries. Therefore, Peter's revolution was to bring order out of the manufactured chaos in a city that he had just created, cut out of the frozen swamps of Northern Europe. He created a new organization, both ecclesial and political, to rule over a country he wanted to subdue. He wanted to create this European or modern European monarchy on Hobbes's model. You have people who are so ignorant they actually believe that in the English Civil War, Thomas Hobbes was a monarchist, as if Hobbes's purely individualist and reductionist point of view could ever be associated with traditional monarchy. Now, it just so happens, as I've said this before, no real transformation in church area developed until Peter returned from the Great Embassy, if that was in fact Peter. It's interesting that one of the first things he did when he got back was to cancel the Palm Sunday procession in 1698. something happened. Either it's not the same guy. I've mentioned this before. There's a lot of reasons it's not the same guy. Either way, the man who left, either literally or metaphorically, was not the same man who returned. He came back allegedly to smash the Streltsy uprising of the traditionalist military in Moscow, and he tortured them to death. It wasn't just smashing rebellion. He wanted the entire country to know what would happen. It is absolutely ruthless what he was going to do to smash any traditional force. This is what he was going to do to introduce European behaviors. He introduced a new calendar, of course. No one talks about this. A new calendar which started the years at Christ's birth, not the creation of the world. That is a calendar reform that was condemned by the old believers at the time. Shaving of the beards was a big deal. He was mixing the genders in that case. It's not an accident that he shaves the beards for men exactly as he introduces these orgiastic rites of Dionysius, which includes men and women, and ends the so-called terem, or the enforced segregation of women for social events, which we all know now is probably a pretty good idea if you got someone like Peter around. Bringing in the Ukrainians, I mentioned Prokopovich, most of whom were unionists at one time, and again, this is nothing new under Alexei and Fedor. Immigrants from Ukraine always, you know, came in and had strong functions. But subordinating the clergy under foreigners was very important. After Peter came from his second trip abroad, after Patriarch Adrian died, the monastic order was repressed. So he represses the patriarchate also by repressing monasticism. He had pagan statues all over his new city. He took everything that wasn't nailed down, especially if it belonged to the church. And that's where he financed the building of Petersburg. He destroyed the economic basis of church autonomy. Just so happens that while he was in London, he became obsessed with the Quakers. He knew William Penn. And he says, this is a doctrine for human happiness. Quakers were okay. Now, as he completely remade the church, he purged every diocese at one time or another, smashed the patriarch, introduced a new calendar, enforced a new rite, of course, introduced all kinds of Protestant elements, put bishops in that were probably not Orthodox. They certainly weren't Orthodox, but what they actually were is controversial. There was not an elementary foundation of church life under Peter. And no one existed left to protest. The dioceses were really without bishops for many years. Novgorod didn't have a bishop from 1716 to 1721. Smolensk from 1704 to 1707. Kiev from 1718 to 1722. Irtush from 1713 to 1721. At any given moment, about 25% of the dioceses in the Russian church were empty. He had destroyed, murdered, exiled the bishops of the church. There was no canonical regularity. Rather, he consecrated himself after showing his support for the Quakers, consecrated himself officially and publicly to the religion of Dionysius. Now, what was the response here? There was quite a bit of fear and indignation in what, of course, was a pious country. They would claim that the revelers would go from house to house, were prepared for death. It could be one of two things, either Peter's drunken rage, where he did kill people, or alcohol overdose, which was very common. No one saw him as a legitimate monarch at the time. No one did. Remember, Peter did all this without asking anybody. The church had no role in any of this. Peter had no right to do this. No synod of bishops asked Peter to introduce a new structure of the church authority. No council legitimized any of this. The spiritual rules that he drew up had no synodal input. Of course, the mass of what remained of the clergy was vehemently against him. So there was no canonical foundation for anything that happened. He was, as most of you know, Peter declared himself the head of the church. And he had complete and total control over the activities of the Supreme Church Authority. And if the synod wasn't in session, the state would directly control the church at the highest levels. The idea of the organization destroyed the idea of the organism. The problem was, of course, no one in Russia shared this enthusiasm for revolution. How successful this Sobor was, and going from house to house, mocking the church, being wasted, having all these weird sex rites right out, you know, right out in public. And even you know, the spiritual regulation, the spiritual rules, the book that governed this reform was called the Cursed Book. And the old belief, of course, deepened its hold on the population. Now, Peter's grandson, Peter II, only ruled for a very short time. There was a massive opposition party that was developing. The main one was led by Archbishop Yuri of Rostov, who died in 1739, and he wanted to overthrow the synodal form of government and restore the patriarchate. Of course, at the beginning of the reign of Elizabeth, two important members of the synod, one of my favorite saints, the new martyr of the 18th century, Saint Arsenio of Rostov, Matsievich, who was murdered in 1772, and Archbishop of Novgorod, Ambrose, Yushkevich, who died in 1745, developed project for the restoration of the Patriarchate. At some length, one dated April 5th, 1742, the other one May 10th, 1744. No one from this point on accepted Peter's church reform as legitimate. Peter was able to do what he did because he mobilized the entire country for wars, both in Northern and Southern Europe. And at a gigantic cost, he was able to win some of them. There was an outrage in the Russian population, not only of Peter's Sobor, so-called synod, creating his drunken patriarch while he's suppressing the real one. He's having drinking parties where he's making believe we are wearing clerical garb while actual clerics are in prison. The Spiritual Regulation, which is the book that governs all of this, is a book of persecution. Gulubinsky, the famous historian, called Peter's church policy state heresy. In A.P. Lebedev's History of the Greek Church Under the Rule of the Turks, he says that even when the Turks took over Constantinople, there's nothing that they did ever that came close to what Peter did to the episcopate. There was no mass confiscation of property. There was no deposition of bishops. There was no mass tortures and killings. Nothing like this. The only time this ever happened was under Peter, and then, of course, later the Bolsheviks. The church was completely paralyzed. He remade church architecture. You couldn't do icons on wood. It had to be on canvas. Churches couldn't have domes anymore. All local chapels were destroyed. Any local site for veneration was bulldozed. He decreed openly, and I quote, "There are no relics, and all miracle stories are inventions," he said. It was forbidden to burn candles in front of icons outside of the church. Even almsgiving was banned. Beggars were caught and sent to hard labor. Those who gave alms, there was a fine of 5 rubles. And we all know Peter demanded that the seal of confession be broken if the penitent had anything negative to say about Peter. He tried to ban monasticism. His first set of decrees was to turn monasteries into military hospitals, and monks became orderlies. Convents were forced into sewing factories, and making lace and silk fabrics. The Bolsheviks did the exact same thing. And because the clergy had no freedom, this Petrine and post-Petrine era showed a decline in folk morals. People forget how significant monasteries are to Western history. Peter called them the gangrene of the state. The decree of 1701 dealt with monasticism, which is an addition to the spiritual regulation. And it was a declaration of war against the monks. And Peter called it, of course, right in the book, he called it a prejudice of ancient times. Peter says this, he says, and what they say, what do they pray? And everyone prays. They pray together. What profit is society from this? Truly an old saying, not to God nor to man, it's for those who want to flee from taxes and indulge in laziness so they can eat bread for nothing. That was his view of monasticism. He was so impressed by the Protestants and Prokopovich, and of course spending all his time in the German quarter growing up, this is where, and Protestants didn't have monks, this is where he decided to end it. January 26, 1723, he issued a decree that banned all new tonsures and all empty places taken by retired soldiers as a 1722 addition to the spiritual regulation. And abbots were being told what to do. Generally speaking, becoming tonsured a monk under Peter was almost impossible. You had to have direct permission of the state for this. Education was taken out of monastic hands. The strange thing is that what Peter was claiming, just like the Bolsheviks, that monasteries should be centers of charity. But they already were. That's not what Peter wanted. Charity for him meant something that served his interests at the moment. Military hospitals or cheap labor, whatever it is. They always had hospitals. They always had almshouses. But without the monastic foundation, the charity doesn't mean anything. So Peter would use these places to send anybody that he had no use for. So many of these homes were already in operation, but now without the monastic foundation, there was nothing. The thing that made them function was gone. So they were under the direct control of the state. Monasticism almost collapsed. In 1740, long after Peter's death, the synod said, many monasteries are without monks, monastery churches without services. There was no one to assign to the monastery services, either abbots or schools for children. Monasticism was declining. They feared, of course, that it would totally disappear in Russia, how they ended their report in this respect. Peter knew that by destroying the monks, he destroyed the church and eliminated the source of bishops and missionaries. Again, Lenin took up his mantle almost to the letter. So, the sobor, the drunken sobor, was meant to institutionalize the Dionysian idea. As Nietzsche would say, it's this everything that the passions have in common, the passions at their most primeval level. Simply the will to power. Power based on absolutely nothing but will. There's no good reason for it. It simply exists. They were there to lampoon and mock the church, offering all kinds of sexuality and all kinds of drugs and alcohol and even elite status to people rather than the ascetic life that they were used to. Peter, in his drunken rages, did kill people. He did beat people. Alcohol overdoses were everywhere, and severe health problems did develop when he forced sometimes even elderly people to drink huge amounts of vodka to see how far he could push them. These crazy marriages, forcing the elderly to marry each other and have these pyramids and everything else, these are eyewitness documents here. For all of this, you have the main one, of course, is L.A. Trachtenberg. And then Losovich, which is published by Russian Antiquity in 1874. Chernovsky's Essays on the History of the Russian Church, which is in Russian. Samara and Stephen Dvorsky and Fyodor Prokopovich is another one. There's so many of these that you have to know Russian, but this is everything. The collection of decrees and orders from the Department of Orthodox Confessions needs to be consulted to see some of this. A.B. Kardashev's On the Orthodoxy of Fyodor Prokopovich is worthwhile. Essays on the History of the Russian Church, which I think is in English, the YMCA 1959 by Kardashev. And the Old Believers, of course, have a great writer, A. Shigalov, the sacrilegious, all joking, all drunken synod of fools and jesters, which is his translation of Tsar Antichrist Peter the Great. And that comes from the Pomorian Online Church Library. And then Boris Bashalov's The History of Russian Freemasonry, 1992, which I don't think exists in English at all. So, among contemporary, that doesn't include contemporary documents. This is what the man did. The point was to shock, was to mock, was to get people to realize that the church no longer has any sway in the new pagan city. And he was completely dedicated himself to Bacchus and Dionysius. One of the reasons I say that the man may be possessed is partially because he didn't sleep much. He was always moving. He never stood still. His temper tantrums were absolutely out of control. He killed a lot of people personally. What he did to his wife, we can't get into it. Talked about it somewhere else. The concubines were beyond a normal man. And of course, he tricked his son, Alexei, who was vehemently opposed to what he was doing, and he tortured him to death, sometimes personally. He didn't only torture his son to death, he didn't just, didn't just kill him, but spent quite a bit, he was whipped 24 times, at least in one document. He did the same to all of his, everyone around him, including his second wife. What he did to the Streltsy Uprising when he first took over is even the Bolsheviks didn't do this. He had a particular penchant for causing pain. And somehow pain was a symbol for his dominance. The point was to connect the bizarre nature of this Sobor, this council that he was building, this alternative to the church, dedicated to Dionysius, all these crazy names and titles, and the train bears, and the comedians, and getting wasted and half naked in the snow in Petersburg. And, this was the first step in confusing and mocking the Russian population, a population that he despised. The church was completely crushed by the time he died, and it took a very long time to recover. Nietzsche's concept was to connect both the orderly world of Apollo and the disorderly chaos of Dionysius. The idea being, of course, that Peter, in an alchemical way, had to dissolve Russia into its prime matter, into its elements, and then to rebuild from there. Part of the idea of dissolving comes from this synod. In some cases, literally dissolving in alcohol. It's one thing to have a violently oppressive social system. It's another thing to actually do some of this stuff yourself personally. Because Peter was so big, he actually was able to physically beat and harm his opponents, including his son. One of the big arguments that it really wasn't Peter's son is that he tortured him to death. And all he really wanted to do was retire to a monastery. There's no evidence of any attacks against him, but of course, like typical people like Peter, he eventually went paranoid completely. This Sobor needs to get more attention. This is the entity that helped purge and destroy the church at the time. No one talks about this. Everything that we see in American culture or anti-culture was found in miniature there. That was his first shot across the bow, or shot into the bow, against Russia. This was a behavior that's now going to balance off the orderly world of Christian life and family. St. Petersburg was an officially pagan city with all kinds of Gnostic rituals. These are just the most bizarre. And this Sobor existed for 30 years as a centrally important meeting place for everyone who mattered in Peter's entourage. You became part of Peter's entourage because you were a part of this madcap, old drunken Sobor, whatever it is. I have all kinds of different translations, but the same, it's all the same thing. It is his Jacobin spitting on the church and the very crown that he wore on his head that he despised. This was Peter the Great. This is also the modern world. This is enlightened absolutism. And this is something you're not going to hear from anyone else. Anyway, I appreciate your donations to my cause. I thank you for them. Thank you for listening as always, and I will talk to you next time.